As you wish, as you wish.
There's more to be said there, but we'll turn now to some Q&A. And if you'd like to raise your hands, the stewards with the roving mics will come to you. Okay, seeing quite a few questions around. Gentleman in the middle there. Yep, that's you. Okay, try and get the...
You were talking about a secular university system and stuff like that. Now, I believe you're from Liberty University, which was founded by Jerry Falwell, right? Who said that if you can burn this university down, if it ever becomes liberal, you have to sign up to a code where you say that you believe in the Bible before you join the university. Is that right?
I didn't hear your last question.
Sorry, before you join Liberty University, you have to sign to a code which says you believe in the Bible.
I do?
Well, anyone who wants to study it, let me know.
No, that's not true. No. Well, you can be an atheist and be accepted at Liberty University.
Really?
Yes, sir. Ken can go to Liberty. In fact, I hope he does.
I'm not really good at it.
No, I understand. Repeat the question.
If you wanted to use evidence and data to back up your assumption,
sure.
Are you not starting off with something here?
Good question. And I appreciate his attitude. In case you didn't hear, he said, I'm not, you know, picking on you and so on. I've been asked to repeat the question. I'm probably not going to do a great job with repeating it, but it goes something like this. You talk about the secular university system. That's because I'm in this country, and I was talking about guys who teach at those major schools I mentioned. But he said, what about your university? It's a religious school. Don't students have to be Christians to sign a statement of faith to go there? No drinking and no this and no this and no this. No, you can be an atheist and come to Liberty University. Now, is it a Christian university? Yes, it is. But listen, I make no qualms about being an evangelical Christian. I do not hide that. It's everything I write. Nobody who knows me thinks I'm trying to hide that or trying to pretend like Liberty's like Oxford. Nothing like that. I'm just saying that here's my whole point. The guys I'm quoting are from Harvard, Yale, Stanford, Oxford, Cambridge.
If you were willing to accept that there was a flaw in the story, that maybe you could be uncovered, that this group right there, or this group is any other part of it, would you really ever have become a philosophy professor at a university like that?
Would I still be there? No, you're right, I wouldn't be. I wouldn't go there and hold that. But that's not my point. Here's my whole question. Using the fellows that I started tonight from these major British universities and many, many other schools, here's my question. Can I, as a Christian, okay, if you say, well, listen, tell me the truth. What do you think about the Bible? You're asking, and if you ask me this, I'll say, hey, listen, I think the Bible is the Word of God. I think it's a trustworthy book. I would tell you that, but that's not the way I started. Tonight, I want to ask, are there enough pieces of data from well-known scholars that I don't have to do this from my viewpoint? I will not come here and say, I believe the Bible is inspired. Let's start with that and see if there's a resurrection. Wow, there's a resurrection. Okay, I'm going to believe. No, I'm saying, can we start with people like, I won't repeat them again, but these major universities around us here, can we start with their presuppositions and get there? And I'm saying, yes, it's really irrelevant where I teach or what I believe. I'll just concede for you, I'm an evangelical Christian. I'm okay with that. But here's what I'm asking. Could you still get there on non-evangelical presuppositions? That's my question.
Josh, can I make a contribution here? Because we've heard the question, I hope, and we've heard Gary's response. Let me quote from Liberty University's own website, and it reads as follows. Faculty join Liberty only after completing a rigorous interview process that confirms a born-again relationship with Christ, a clear understanding of the purpose and aims of Liberty. Now, to me, that doesn't sound as if that would take on board an atheist.
No. I'm talking about a student.
A student.
I thought he said, could you go there? And you definitely can be an atheist.
Let's move on to the next question.
Okay.
Yes, you said that the story that you told would supply sufficient evidence for a non-evangelical to consider that that story is correct. Well, on the basis that that statement is made, then is it not the case that Joseph Smith, who we certainly know existed, and had eyewitness testimony of the angel Moroni, his testimony, which is much more recent and followed by millions of Americans as well, or whatever else, who are often very intelligent people, why should we believe a possibly conjectural figure from 2,000 years ago and not believe Joseph Smith or the Prophet Muhammad, or actually, for that matter, one of perhaps 20 million Americans who have been abducted by aliens? Particularly given the fact that the Gospels do not agree with each other in almost any major respect as far as when or even where or by whom or by how many people this individual was seen. Matthew 27:53 tells us that the graves opened after an earthquake as Jesus died. And 3 days later, dozens or a large quantity of the Jewish saints were resurrected as well, walked up into the city of Jerusalem, and were seen by many people. Now, if we throw that out as evidence, it's funny how we never hear Christians talking about that. You would have thought that that would be a spectacular piece of evidence for the divinity of Christ. That is very, very much under the carpet. If we throw that out, what on earth warrant could we have to suppose that, let's say he did exist, right? This guy...
Thank you. I think we've got the gist of the question.
Well, fine. Okay.
I didn't hear it.
How did he even recognize it was Jesus? He'd never met him before.
Repeat it, then I won't have to repeat.
The first part of the question was about the existence of the Mormon Church. Why should this audience believe you, Gary, over Joseph Smith and his account of faith? And the second part of the question was about Matthew 27:53, and to do with the breaking of the tombs. I understand it in Matthew 27. Why don't Christians use that evidence more?
Why don't we use it more?
Mm.
Okay. Two questions. Mormonism, Matthew 27. Folks, it's not my job tonight. I'm not trying to go after any other belief system. I'm not trying to say you're a loser for this or that. That's not my job. But if I were to investigate the Mormon claim and say, isn't this the same sort of claim? You have eyewitnesses, they were early. I guess that's where you're going. They're early eyewitnesses and so on. One major problem with this is that there are witnesses who were supposed to have seen the plates and so on and so on, and virtually every single one of them whose name is not Smith left or got kicked out of the church. Now, if you tried to import that into the New Testament, you'd say, well, we have these 12 guys, but Peter got kicked out for this, so-and-so walked out. What I'm saying is, it's a different situation. I'm just saying it's not analogous, okay? It's not analogous on the grounds of data. As far as Matthew 27, I have a really easy response, and it goes like this. I'm not trying to defend everything in the Bible tonight. I want to talk about this, and if you said to me, I'm not saying you're saying this, but if you said, I don't like Matthew 27, and I said, man, that's part of it. And you go, well, I don't like it. You go, fine. But I'm discussing this. Let's just make it this way. I could say to you, you're right. You're right. Have it your way on Matthew 27. Okay. It's not the resurrection of Jesus. So I could say, hey, I'm here to discuss the resurrection. What do you do about this? See, again, let me repeat this. My methodology is to accept what critical scholars accept and to talk about that. They don't like Matthew 7:53 and following. You're right. So I don't bring it up because it's not one of the datum they want to speak about. So I'm not free to speak about it because I will only... In other words, my methodology voids the whole thing unless critical scholars concede it. They don't concede that. You're correct. So I won't use it. I don't talk about it because I'm in their genre. I'm in their timeline. This is developed by them, not by conservatives.
Well, yeah, I'll only make a small point because I think the point is well made. if the basis of Gary's claims for the resurrection are true of Christianity, or that particular the mainstream Christianity, it should surely be true of the Mormon Church. I mean, in a sense, we have no doubt that the Smith family existed. There's no ambiguity there. So, yeah, why believe one or the other? Well, of course, really, in our heart of hearts, we know they're both fraudulent. Of course, the opening of the tombs and you know, Gary's methodology has to be admired. It's pick and mix, whatever will fit. You know, if that one won't work, let's get the next one. You know, it's admirable approach. You know, it's sort of like any contingency will do. Doesn't convince me.
Let's go on to the next question, please. Okay, let's have. Let's have this lady at the front here, please.
Thank you, Chairman. Well, of course, we're talking about everything because it's so obscure. The Bible is so obscure. But we're really going on about source criticism tonight. And I wanted to ask you really about what's Paul's angle and put it to you like this. Say you have a Jewish group who have created a religion, their own God, and it's one God, and it's only one God. Don't you need then to do something about the rest of the world? How are you going to bring them into the story? And wouldn't you need to create an alternate angle for them to pursue, like the Noahide? Wouldn't you need to create something? Wouldn't Paul actually have needed to create a new religion? The sidekick for Judaism would be Christianity. Wouldn't Saul have been dubious? Wouldn't he have a vested interest in creating something to bring us all into the belief in this one God, a Jewish God? Isn't there some angle there that he has that we need to think of if we're really looking at source criticism?
Okay, I'm using... This whole thesis assumes source criticism, so I'm using source criticism, and that source criticism is a generic title under which there are several kinds of criticism, and that's the sort I'm using here. As far as why wouldn't Paul want to do something like this, from every source we know, whether it's Acts or Paul's own epistles, these genuine epistles, Philippians chapter 1, Galatians chapter 1, Paul, 1 Corinthians 15, Paul says, I persecuted the church. When he was Saul, let's put it this way, there's not a speck of evidence that implies or says or indicates, not a speck of first century data that says that Paul was tired, wanted to give up, wanted to switch sides, wanted to universalize Judaism. I think that would be a very foreign set of ideas to New Testament scholarship. I mean critical New Testament scholarship. I don't see Paul wanting to do anything. He wanted to wipe the sect out. He said, I thought I was doing God a favor by taking men, women, and children and imprisoning or killing them. If we accept Acts as historical, he sits at the feet of the man Stephen while he's stoned. I don't see any evidence to believe that Paul wants to start a religion. Now, see, here's one of the things I would say. Why do we need to give a bunch of evidences for this, but we can have a theory like maybe Paul went off the deep end, or maybe Paul wanted to spread a universal religion, but no evidence for it? There's no evidence that Paul wanted to move in a different direction. But sometimes we feel that if we give the opposite side, we can speak without evidence. Sometimes we can just postulate. My other reason for that, number one, no evidence. Paul says he did the opposite. Second, on this timeline, that was one of the main things I was referring to. This wasn't Paul's idea. Paul got it from somebody else. Paul gets it from Peter, James, John. Now Paul also saw Jesus, if you believe the New Testament accounts. But what I'm saying is, the whole point of this was, it wasn't Paul's idea. And then when I mentioned Hurtado and Jimmy Dunn and Richard Baucom taking it back to 30 AD, Paul wasn't a believer. I mean, that's when he was fighting against the church. So in other words, the people who were around, who were teaching the deity of Christ and the resurrection before Paul, that would show you it's not Paul's idea. If it predates Paul, it's not Paul. So I would say two large arguments are, number one, you have to answer this data and why people have it before Paul. And my first point was, we don't have one bit of data that says that Paul was this or that and decided to start a new religion. I don't think we're justified in starting something new starting a thesis without data.
To contribute there, certainly some scholars do maintain that Paul is the true author of Christianity. My own comment would be that we shouldn't look for a simplistic explanation for the phenomenon of Christianity. The Christian world today is a house divided. We all know that in many, many sects. It was no different in the early days. Christianity has always been divided, and certainly in that crucial period of the first couple of centuries, there were a multitude of different creeds, different Christianities, and the Pauline trend was just one of them, and that's a fact that we should realise, that the Gospels as we know them are the result of a struggle between those groups over a couple of hundred years.
Let's turn to the next question, please. And yes, this gentleman down at the front, please. Thank you.
Thank you. This is a question for Mr. Humphreys primarily, and it's just a question of motive, really. I was wondering why, what it is about the person of Jesus that you think persuaded so many thousands of Jews who had clung to their beliefs religiously, if you excuse the pun, for several centuries in the face of considerable persecution from most of the empire's gang. What was it about the person of Jesus that provoked them to throw in, or at least substantially modify, many of these beliefs? Or to put it another way, what was it particularly about the early believers that made them so incredibly persuasive that they could, well, really alter a religion that had showed remarkable resilience in not being possible to alter it for so many centuries?
A good question. And it's one of the pillars of the historical Jesus school, that there was this mass conversion and the church grew in some explosive fashion. The problem is, outside of Christian references, that is a position that one cannot maintain. The interesting thing about early Christianity is its invisibility. It wasn't so apparent. Now, we have the alternative, we have the option of believing the Big Bang origin, in other words, the birth of a Messiah from a virgin and the crucifixion and the resurrection. That would be one explanation if you want to. But another explanation, which I think is more convincing, is that Christianity emerged from Judaism as a result of the suffering of the Jewish people. They had waged and lost two major wars with Rome, and that was a crisis for their religion. And that, I think, was the impetus for the emergence of the various Christian sects. And it fits the evidence more closely, because you cannot, no matter how many claims are made, I know there are references in the book of Acts for, you know, 3,000 converts, it claims, after the episode of speaking in tongues. You know, but, you know, do we really believe that happened? There is no historical residue of any mass conversion of the Jews until a century or so later. So, you know, I don't accept that something miraculous came along and converted Jews from a faith. It was the suffering in the wars against Rome that led to their religion breaking into more than one element.
Real quickly, two recent Jewish scholars, non-Christian, no Christian axe to grind. Pincus Lapid, 1982, The Resurrection of Jesus, A Jewish Perspective, and very, very recently, just appeared off the press, Geza Vermesh, professor, Jewish history professor emeritus, Oxford University. Two Jews, not Christian, both examined the data. Conclusion, Jesus was raised from the dead. No axe to grind. I think that's interesting. Nobody... He says, nobody outside of the book of Acts recorded the explosion of early Christianity. Let me give you some names. Josephus, Tacitus, Suetonius. Three Roman historians. If you count Josephus as a Roman historian, count him as a Jewish historian, whatever you want. All three of them. Tacitus says, after this pernicious doctrine was destroyed, he said, when Pilate killed Jesus, he says the thing broke out again and spread around. It came all the way around the empire to Rome. So does Suetonius. Josephus talks about this. I'm just saying we have this recorded from other people. And one comment about the four Gospels came out of a struggle of centuries. Folks, listen. As the first century closed, there were only four Gospels in existence. It's not my fault if the early church took the only four books there were at that time. They just happened to be the Gospels. It wasn't like there were 10 others and they ignored them. They were the only four that were around in 100 AD.